Good morning, Your Honors, gentlemen. Robert Podol, registration number 8776, appearing on behalf of Citywide Banks. Our first proposition, did the trial court err in ruling that the professional negligence of the insured, in this case an escrow company, was excluded and not covered by a professional negligence insurance policy? The conduct of the insured in this case was negligent in disbursing money from an escrow. This was not a case where the insured took the money. This is not a case where the insured misplaced the money. Excuse me. The insured was acting in his professional capacity, conducting real estate closings, and negligently dispersed escrow money. This, I think we should note, was precisely the risk that this policy was intended to insure. The trial court, in reaching its conclusion that the negligence of the insured was not covered, first applied the label appended to the claim by the parties in the underlying action, that being conversion. Even in its order, however, the trial court recognized that the conversion was premised upon the negligent conduct of the insured in dispersing the escrow monies. After applying the label of conversion, which we submit was the first error the trial court made, the trial court applied a super technical analysis, finding the legal definition of conversion. The trial court addressed the negligent intentional act dichotomy, which we had used for analysis, rejected that dichotomy by conducting analysis of the mens rea attached to criminal conversion and distinguishing that from civil conversion. Upon reaching the conclusion that the negligent intentional act dichotomy was not useful to the trial court in this case, the trial court then concluded that therefore the negligence of the insured was not covered. We believe the trial court missed a step in this analysis. We ask you to compare the analysis in the Northland versus Stewart title case cited at some length by Evanston in this case. There, the Sixth Circuit did, as the trial court did, reject the negligent intentional acts dichotomy. But then the court in Northland said, okay, there are covered acts and there are excluded acts. And what type of act was the insured up to? Was it a covered act? Was it excluded from coverage? We think that's the step that the trial court missed in this case. Because if you look at what was covered by the policy and if you look at what was excluded, clearly the policy covered the professional negligence of the insured, and clearly the policy excluded from coverage covers the conversion of the insured, which if you interpret or construe by its ordinarily accepted meaning, then you talk about the insured taking the money. That's the ordinarily accepted meaning of conversion. However, that's not what the trial court did. We think the trial court ignored in reaching its conclusion several principles which are essential in insurance construction. The exclusions, and we were dealing with an exclusion here, are narrowly construed in favor of coverage. Coverage is determined by the nature of the conduct of the insured, not the labels applied by the parties in the underlying case. And that has to be the case, otherwise parties could just plead into coverage, as in Northland. Northland was a plead into coverage case, which the Sixth Circuit rejected, excuse me. The terms of a policy, including the exclusion, are interpreted according to their commonly accepted meaning. And in this case, the commonly accepted meaning of conversion is clearly the insured taking the money. And then finally, if the terms of a policy provision are capable of two distinct meanings, they are ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage. If what the trial court set out turns out to be correct, that applying the technical definition of conversion, that it could apply to the professional negligence of the insured, now we have two plausible definitions of conversion. It is therefore ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage. I don't think you even need to get there, but if you do, if the trial court were correct, all you have is an ambiguity.
Well, speaking about getting to something, the judge gave an alternative reason for granting summary judgment. In fact, most of his order, as I read it, dealt with the primary reason that there was never a claim within the definition of the policy made to the insured during this claims made policy period.
A perfect segue to the second part of my argument, and I thank you.
You're welcome.
The second proposition of the trial court. Did the trial court err in holding that letters which were received by the insured weren't received by the insured? I can almost stop there. That's what the trial court held. The trial court held that letters which were physically received by the president and sole shareholder, sole owner of the insured, were not received by the insured.
Well, the court applied the definition in the policy
yes. Of
the word claim. A word that appears in the definition section of the policy, completely different from notice to the insurer. Those are two totally different concepts, as I understand it.
I agree with you.
And the court said that the definition of claim is a written demand for money damages. Here the court found that there was no claim made by the, by your client, and there was no claim made upon the insured, because the letter that you talk about was addressed to somebody else and came from somebody else.
Yes.
So what authority is there to, how could you define that such a concept, such occasion as a written demand for money damages? It clearly means money damages against the insured. It seems to be money damages that would have to be for the claimant.
But that's not what the policy said. The interesting part of this case, which you just led me to, is, I think, simply this. If we were talking about a claim under the common law definition of what a claim might be, then I think we have a large factual dispute. We should have a hearing down at the trial court level and decide whether these letters constituted a claim. But we're not dealing with the common law definition of claim. The claim is defined for our purposes in the policy that Evanston wrote. And that policy definition has three elements. It's the receipt by the insured. Well, do we have to argue that the insured received this? I mean, the insured physically got it. It was obtained by the president of the insured.
But the letter was addressed to a different entity.
It was addressed to a different entity, but it was received by the insured. If the policy had said sent to the insured as opposed to received by the insured, I could see the argument.
But the insured, according to the policy, is not Miss Austin. I'm looking at the cover of the policy. Insured is Austin Escrow and Title LLC.
Which is
Austin.
An incorporeal entity. How does an incorporeal entity receive anything? I submit to you that receipt, physical receipt by the president and sole owner of an incorporeal entity is the gold standard of receipt. What more could you ask for?
Well, you could ask for the letter to be addressed to the actual name of the insured.
You could, but that doesn't have anything to do with the receipt of it, which is a physical act. It got there. Maybe there was a risk when it was sent that it wouldn't get there because it was addressed improperly. But it got there. It was received. What's the next element in the policy? The next element is of a written demand for money. It doesn't say a written demand for money addressed to anyone in particular. It says a written demand for money. Was this a written demand for money?
And it wasn't from your client.
It was not.
It was from an entirely different entity.
It is, but Evanston's policy takes care of that problem.
But according to your explanation, that if she got a letter from, a credit card company saying you owe us money, that's a claim for money. That would trigger coverage and allow your client to come in a year later and file a suit against
it. Absolutely not. But what's the reason for that? The reason isn't that it wasn't received. It was. The reason is it wasn't a written demand for money. It is. The reason in your hypothetical is that it wouldn't involve the professional negligence of the company. That's the third element in the definition of a claim. So if we were to follow the definition of a claim, and this is what's interesting, if we were to follow the definition of a claim in the Evanston policy, we have receipt, we have a written demand for money, and we have it because it alleged the professional negligence of this insured, it involves this policy. Now, I don't know that that's where this should go. A little background. We Citywide sued the insured. Citywide suit was served upon the insured 3 days after the Evanston policy expired. The insured tendered the policy to both of its carriers, Evanston the prior period, Westchester the current period. Evanston was quick to deny the claim 3 days later, sent a denial. This was outside our policy period. Westchester, on the other hand, whose policy period it did fall into, as you would expect, did a thorough investigation and found these letters and said, we deny coverage because the claim was made by these letters in Evanston's policy. And they both have good arguments. And Citywide is sitting there with a judgment, and we're not able to discern in whose policy period claim was made. So we brought two simultaneous writs of garnishment. We asked for them to be consolidated, they were, and we asked the court to hold a hearing and tell us in which policy period the claim was made. Now, if we were dealing with the common law definition of a claim, this would be a wild and woolly hearing. This would be really good. And we don't really have a dog in this fight. We want the court to tell us in which policy period the claim was made. But certainly as a matter of law, given the definition of the Evanston policy, the definition of claim in the Evanston policy, you cannot as a matter of law say that this was not a claim made in the Evanston period, because it fits the three-part definition of claim in the Evanston policy. Yes, sir.
Under your reading of the definition of claim, it doesn't matter who sends the notice.
It doesn't matter who sends a notice, not because of the definition of claim, but another provision in the Evanston policy, which says that if another entity makes a claim based upon the same wrongdoing, then any subsequent claims by other entities are all considered the same claim and relate to the time that the first entity made the claim.
So that's the Evanston policy. If I had sent a letter, that would have been sufficient.
I'm sorry?
If I had sent a letter, that would have been sufficient.
Well, I don't know that you've been wrong, but to follow your hypothetical, if it was the same wrongdoing, which is what the Evanston policy says, and this is quoted in the reply brief, that provision, if it's the same wrongdoing, then the Evanston policy itself says it's the same claim. We don't have to say anything. Can I reserve the rest of my scant time for rebuttal?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Morning. May it please this court. On behalf of Evanston Insurance Company, my name is Franz Hardy, registration number 32286. With me at council table is Ross Hugerhigh, registration number 42588. As this court is aware, the issue presented is whether coverage is afforded for Citywide Bank's claim under a claims made and reported insurance policy issued by Evanston to Austin Escrow. On appeal, Citywide Banks makes three arguments as to why this court should reverse the district court's determination that there is no coverage. One, a claim was made under the policy. Two, the conversion exclusion does not apply. And three, coverage would be illusory. However, as I will explain, these arguments are not supported either by legal authority or the facts. Therefore, this court should affirm the district court's determination. As to the first argument, Citywide's claim was not made during the policy period. Citywide impermissibly attempts to collapse two separate events to argue that there is coverage. It is important to look at them separately. First of all, as to Citywide, the events are fairly simple. The policy period at issue is from February 8, 2009 to February 8, 2010. Again, as to Citywide, it filed its complaint against Evanston on February 11, 2010, 3 days after the policy expired. Citywide served its complaint on Austin Escrow on February 15, 2010, 1 week after the policy expired. Citywide even admits in the underlying garnishment proceeding that it did not make a claim against Austin Escrow within the policy period.
The first notice that Boston Escrow got that Citywide was making a claim against it was service of the lawsuit in February, letter in February of 2010.
That's exactly correct.
There was never a notice letter or a claim letter.
There is no evidence of a notice or claim letter. The first receipt by Austin Escrow is on February 15th, 2010, after the policy period expired. Simply under these basic facts, there is no Citywide's claim was not made during the policy period, and there is no coverage for its claim.
At the risk of causing a little confusion, let me ask you this question. When Innovative got the letter from, I think it's Southern Title, did it make it? Was Innovative then insured by Evanston?
No, it was insured by Zurich Insurance Company.
Okay, so Innovative may have passed on the claim to Zurich, but it certainly didn't pass on that letter from Southern to Evanston.
Correct.
It had no reason to.
Okay. It had no reason to. In fact, we know from the record that Innovative Title did in fact pass the letter along to its insurance company, Zurich. Mm-hmm. Innovative Title nor Austin Escrow ever passed the letters along to Evanston. In fact, the only reason, Your Honor, that Evanston learned of those letters was through this garnishment proceeding. They were never tendered to Evanston. So Your Honor picks up on the other hand, so we have a set of facts that are fairly simple as to Citywide. But then we have Southern Title. Southern Title is a non-party to these proceedings, and it sent two letters to Innovative Title, a non-insured. And admittedly, that was during the policy period.
No, it's insured, but insured by somebody else.
It's insured by someone else, Zurich, not Evanston. And the letter regards a, quote, potential claim.
The definition of the claim, though, is the insured's receipt of a demand, not Evanston's receipt of a demand. Does that make a difference?
No. You're right, Your Honor, that is the definition, but it does not make a difference because the insured's receipt here, Austin Escrow's receipt of a claim, was not until February 15, 2010, in regards to Citywide's loss. Did I answer your honest question?
There is an argument that it's the same person runs two entities, but you're saying technically there was no notice until after the policy period.
As to Citywide's claim, and even as to the Innovative Title letter, like Your Honor addressed, that is addressed to Innovative Title. It is to Kim Austin, as president of Innovative Title. It does not mention Austin Escrow. In fact, Your Honor mentioned, in turn, she did not turn it over to Evanston. She turned it over to Zurich. So on a lot of levels, that demonstrates that that is not a claim against Austin Escrow. Even if you hypothesize somehow it is a claim against Austin Escrow, Austin Escrow, in turn, never provided notice to its insurance company as like it's required to do.
No, but that's a different argument, it seems to me. And I asked Mr. Paul, I mean, a claim to the insured is defined in the claims, and notice to the insurance company is defined in notice usually. They're really two different things. I understand your point that Evanston never got notice of the claim from Boston, I guess, and she just got sued. But the judge below did not rule on that basis. As I read his order, he did not find as a second reason that no notice was given to exclude insurance.
I think you're right, Your Honor. He didn't have to.
No, I understand. You make an argument on something that I don't think the judge ruled on, although you may well be right about it. I don't think the judge ruled on the fact that no notice was given, because I think notice and claim are two different things in this situation.
I agree. And Your Honor may be absolutely right, as I don't have that order memorized, that the order that the judge took on the first issue and did not have to get to the second issue. But certainly, if you receive the claim, you have to provide notice to the insurance company, and that was not.
And in that regard, I noticed that the policy has a provision called discovery clause. which would allow an insured, when they first become aware of a specific wrongful act, which may result in a claim, to give notice to the insurance company. And I take it nothing of that was ever done here. They're not claiming under the discovery clause in the policy.
Correct. There's no evidence to that effect. There's nothing in the record that there was anything that triggered the discovery clause that Your Honor is referring to.
Okay.
So these are separate events. The events involving Citywide's claim, the events on the purported claim against Innovative Title are simply separate. Nonetheless, Citywide is attempting to combine these sets of events and argue that they afford its admittedly untimely claim with coverage. For a myriad of reasons, as we've discussed, simply the policy does not work that way, and there's just no coverage for Citywide's claim. As one of as Your Honor alluded to, importantly, there's no case law to support this. There's no legal authority that allows coverage under a scenario like this. You simply cannot bootstrap off somebody else's claim from that's not yours to somebody else to somehow extract coverage under the policy. As to Citywide's second argument, the conversion exclusion applies. Citywide argues that the conversion exclusion cannot apply where its express conversion claim is really based upon the negligent disbursement of the proceeds. It also argues that conversion in the context of the exclusion applies only to intentional conduct, not negligent conduct. Under exclusion O, that's the exclusion, the conversion exclusion at issue, taken down to its most basic wording, it simply says there is no coverage for a claim based upon or arising out of any conversion of escrow funds and applies irrespective of which individual committed or caused the conversion. Simply, the district court applied the exclusion as written. Based upon Colorado Supreme Court precedent, the district court determined that conversion is, quote, a distinct unauthorized act of dominion or ownership exercised by one person over personal property belonging to another. Mr. Pohl referred to that as a super technical definition in his initial remarks. That's simply the definition utilized by the Colorado Supreme Court in Eitan versus Unger. Based upon the exclusion and this definition, the exclusion applies given the undisputed facts regarding Citywide's asserted causes of action and the underlying order entering default judgment against Austin Escrow. Citywide simply asserted two claims for relief, conversion and tortious embroiling in litigation due to the conversion. The order entering default judgment against Austin Escrow expressly announced, quote, the wrongful disposition of personal property by a bailee constitutes a conversion. Moreover, a conversion results whereas here, the trial court finds misdelivery of the bail property due to its negligence, end quote.
Are those the allegations of the complaint? Or the allegations, or the findings of the court, I'm sorry.
Those are the findings of the court, Your Honor. The court also found.
I think those findings are actually in the Westchester order, by the way, which I don't think we can. They're not in this order. They're in the Westchester order, okay?
Yes. Okay. The court refers back to the Westchester order.
Which I don't know if we have that in our record here, but anyway, go ahead. I understand what you're talking about. Let's proceed.
Yes, and what I'm quoting is actually the order from the default judgment entered on Citywide's claim against Austin Escrow. The court also found that the court concludes that plaintiff is entitled to entry of default judgment on its claim of conversion based upon the negligence of defendant Austin as a bailee with respect to the payoff proceeds, end quote. So based upon the claims asserted, the order entered, the district court appropriately applied the language of the exclusion to determine that it prevented coverage for Citywide's claim. Finally, as to Citywide's third argument, coverage is not illusory or against reasonable expectations. Citywide argues that the only professional service that Austin Escrow performed was holding and dispersing closing funds. If the policy did not cover Austin Escrow's negligence, In this respect, it ensured nothing, it argues. As a threshold issue, the doctrine of reasonable expectations is unavailable unless the policy is ambiguous or contrary to public policy. Here, the exclusion is not ambiguous and is not against policy. So this court need not even address the argument of reasonable expectations. As to illusory coverage, that only exists when a policy allows the insurer to receive premiums when realistically is not incurring any risk of liability. I cannot theorize all instances of coverage under the Austin escrow policy or the Evanston policy, but coverage is certainly not illusory. For a small example, one could see coverage for claims involving the failure to have the parties execute the proper documents of closing, failure to deliver documents during the closing or other items in escrow, failure to record the right documents during a closing, or failure to follow the instructions provided by the parties during the closing, or other instances. There are also definitions under the policy for wrongful acts and personal injury that contemplate the conduct that's covered. However, under the conversion exclusion, Evanston will not become the guarantor of the loan proceeds at issue. That's what the exclusion is there for. If someone improperly converts these proceeds, Evanston will not guarantee this payment. The policy is not a performance bond. Simply, the conversion exclusion does not somehow render coverage illusory or against reasonable expectations. In conclusion, for the reasons set forth in the district court's order in Evanston's answer brief, there's simply no coverage for Citywide's claim under the Evanston policy. Based upon this, Evanston requests that this court affirm the order granting summary judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Hello again. It seems that the impediments as articulated to the idea that this could have been a claim under the Evanston policy are two. First, that the letters did not come from Citywide, and second, that they were addressed to a different entity. As to the first, there is a part of the policy, Evanston's policy, entitled Multiple Insureds, Claims, and Claimants, and it provides in part that the inclusion herein of more than one insured in any claim where the making of claims by more than one person shall not operate to increase the limits of liability. I skip ahead. More than one claim arising out of a single wrongful act or personal injury or a series of wrongful acts shall be considered a single claim. All such claims, when ever made, shall be treated as a single claim. Such a single claim, whenever made, shall be deemed to be first made on the date on which the earliest claim arising out of such wrongful act or personal injury is made.
But these are limits of liability provisions. These are provisions that are protecting the insurance company in the case of multiple claims by multiple parties arising the same act.
That's what
you're trying to piggyback out of this and say your claim was the same as Southern's, therefore.
That's what the provision says. Right. It says that if more than one party makes a claim based upon the same wrongful conduct, that it's the same claim and it relates to what the claim first made.
So you
didn't invent that.
Right. Also, the policy also says under the definition of claim, it means the insured's receipt of a written demand.
Yeah.
And insurance is capitalized there, which means it's a defined term, right?
Right.
And I'm sure that if I look at the defined term of insured, it means the party identified in item number one on the declaration, which is Austin Escrow, not Ms. Austin.
So
if you want to be technical about the words, don't we have to be technical also about the word insured?
Of course.
Austin Escrow, not Ms. Austin.
Of course. Now,
Austin Escrow, when did Austin Escrow receive a claim?
Austin Escrow received the claim as soon as its president and sole owner received it. Receipt is a physical act.
Okay.
my time is up. I can't go further unless you tell me to.
No, thank you for your arguments. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. We're going to take a short recess to reconstitute the panel, and then we'll hold arguments in the Roberts versus Van Riper case.